The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show, Wednesday, May 16th, 2018. I'm Seth Leibson. He is Chris Buskirk. Say hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
There you go. Bill Clay is our producer. He can be called on your way to getting on air at 602-508-0960. So much happening in the news, and yet we got caught up a little bit here in philosophy and big things, didn't we? Somehow.
As is our wont.
Because we deal with the durables here. And once you get those right, then we can deal with the day-to-day. Then you can deal with the quotidian. Then you can deal with the evanescent much easier. And hopefully not have to deal with it again. It would be nice to solve a problem and not to keep coming back to a problem. I have to say this one thing, though. I was telling Chris on the break a line his friend Sebastian Gorka had on Twitter yesterday, earlier in the week, of course.
It's a good line.
It is a good line. It puts everything in perspective.
You know why it's a good line?
It puts everything in perspective.
It has the benefit of being true.
So big ceremony in Jerusalem, United States recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Not a single Democrat went. Not a single member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate or the House of Representatives went. Which prompted Sebastian Gorka to say, that means more Democrats have met with Louis Farrakhan than would consent to go to Israel to recognize Jerusalem as its capital in a historically momentous time. Yeah. Yeah, that's your modern Democratic Party. Why people still think it is the party of liberalism, I do not understand. Do not understand it. Attendant to the philosophy we're talking about, which is this poll, a few months old now, showing that more millennials would rather live in a socialist or communist country than in a capitalist one, 51% to 44%. 44% being the capitalist option. Attendant to that is this poll of who millennials support in the Democratic Party for presidency. Bernie Sanders comes in a whopping second to 77-year-old Joe Biden, who comes in first. Guess who comes in third?
Kamala Harris.
No, she comes in about fifth.
Elizabeth Warren
comes in fourth.
Who's number? Is it Hillary?
When I tell you, it'll make sense.
It's not Hillary.
No, but it's Oprah.
I laugh, but I shouldn't.
Yeah, right?
I shouldn't.
Right? Right.
Huh. So number one is who?
Biden.
Yeah. Hashtag
probably
me,
name
hashtag
recognition.
Me too.
Yeah, hashtag me too. Biden. Bernie Sanders, Oprah Winfrey. Okay.
But Biden is 77 right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Just checking.
Yeah. Or is he 75 now? He's 75 now. He'll be 77 in 2 years. Sorry. Yeah, I overthought that. He'll be 77 in 2 years. Yeah. Okay.
Uncle Joe with the roaming hands.
Yeah. And the racism. I mean, did you read this Victor Davis Hanson piece at American Greatness the other day about
I am familiar with the site and Dr. Hanson, yes.
The racist statements these guys get away with, right? It's unbelievable. The things he said about Barack Obama, the things he said about.
As did the Clintons, by the way.
The things he said about Asian Indians. Really incredible. Really incredible. The way he talks about the black community.
Whew.
Kanye's got a point.
Kanye also has dragon energy.
Yeah. Do you know how to define dragon energy, or is it you kind of know it when you see it?
It's as with some with other things, you know it when you see it.
You kind of know it when you see it.
Yeah.
Dragon energy. How about a definition of dragon energy being the ability to state a political point and increase the support of your point in the polls by double?
Oh, that's dragon energy for sure.
Okay.
It's
because black male support for Donald Trump doubled after he spoke.
It's not the definition
of dragon
energy. It's an example of dragon energy in use.
Okay.
Kanye has it. Yeah. He's telling us we can just believe it.
And then the Philadelphia Inquirer fact checks Donald Trump's claim. This is so funny.
They should fact check Kanye. Does Kanye claim to have dragon energy?
Yeah.
We have found no evidence.
They might as well do that. So they fact check Donald Trump's claim that support in the African American community went up doubled. They say no, it only doubled in the male vote. Is that even worth the ink it's printed on?
They found
that the entire, if you took not just the male likely voters, but the entire universe of voters, it would have gone 88% up, right? It would have gone up 88%. So they call Trump
a
liar.
Not double.
Gosh knows, not double. That was only the men.
And
they include the women, it's 88%.
And they get criticized for agenda journalism.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Fake news. Even, you know, people are beginning to wake up to this fake news claim. Even Ben Shapiro the other day was tweeting out, as much as he doesn't like the theme fake news, it's hard to avoid when you look at how almost every major media outlet has covered the Gaza riots. Gaza riots. Look at the video of that kid on crutches, all of a sudden throwing away the crutches and running.
This has been going on
for a long time. This baby that was supposedly killed by the Israelis, Gaza doctor says it wasn't from the Israelis. No one, by the way, asking the first question, why do you take a baby to a riot?
A children's book put out by Hamas.
Yeah. How to take a baby to a riot.
Yeah.
How to take a baby to a riot. Yeah. Prompts me to, gosh, help me with the quote. I'll find it. An old quote by Golda Meir. There will be peace in the Middle East when the Palestinians learn to love their children as much as they hate us. I think that's the quote. Well, you see it in sharp relief. Right now, in Gaza. Don't buy this crap. Tom, bear with me. Greg, bear with me. I got to go to Betsy. Betsy is in Phoenix. Hi, Betsy.
Hi there. I know y'all love Jimmy Buffett, and I did too. I used to go out with him. He wrote a song for me when I graduated from med school. There was nobody who idolized Buffett more than I did, and I fully concur with your statement that it takes a capitalistic society to allow for the creativity, because if you're in a communist country and eating a flamingo, you don't have time to think about things like that. But I'm just so disappointed in Buffett these days. He lives in New York. He's become a Democrat. He was always big on the environment, but now it's fundraisers for solar causes, wind energy. He's just not the same guy, and his music's not as fun.
Oh, the music, yeah, no, the new stuff isn't as good anymore, Betsy. That's true. Maybe I should have said Kenny Rogers instead of Jimmy Buffett.
It's an interesting point. It's an interesting point Betsy makes, though. It's not as fun.
It's not as fun.
Right, because
it got political.
It got political, and as progressives do, they lose their sense of humor. They're no fun anymore.
Yeah,
you're spot on. And
Betsy, I got to know the song, though.
I'm looking for a smart woman in a real short.
That's you?
Yeah.
Can we go out with it? I love that song.
Oh, my God. That was 1988.
I used to play that for a girl I used to date. I love that song.
God. Oh, my God.
That's about you?
Yeah, it really is.
The Hot album, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Hot Water.
Hot Water, that's it, where he's jumping over that tidal pool.
Yep.
How am I doing?
Do what?
How am I doing? I know my Jimmy Buffett.
You absolutely do. That's how I met him. I knew my Jimmy Buffett, and a friend of his was there at the concert, and the friend happened to be Ed Podolak, who is a wild man. You may have read about some of his exploits here in Phoenix. He used to be a running back for the Dolphins, and that's how he met. He's from Iowa. But anyway, I'm off the topic. Anyway.
Real short skirt. Betsy, you have got to become a regular. This is one of my favorite. Bimbo Limbo is where I've been.
Bimbo Limbo is where I've been.
Oh, Betsy, you just turned... Gosh.
But
how a good deed treats a weary world, Betsy.
Anyway, just wanted to...
Stay close. Call every day. We have a lot more to talk about. Every day.
I listen to y'all every day. Take care.
Oh, Betsy, I want to listen to you. Thank you. All right, so new rule on this show. If you were a girl about whom a famous musician wrote a song, you're going to the top of the line. That was just great. I don't know how to top that. It sets a high bar for Tom and Greg. Maybe Linda Ronstadt wrote a song about Greg. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I know. You're going to wind up pretty dry here.
Okay.
Sorry. Anyways, no, to the point, obviously the capitalism, socialism thing, we knew our kids were going to, when we first, my son was in grade school, he took a Spanish course, and it turns out that the Spanish teacher taught, which was from Poland, actually taught nothing but the beauty of communism and socialism, mainly socialism.
Odd for a Polish expat to do that, wouldn't you think?
It was bizarre. It was, since my family heritage is Polish, and I know
some of the most
that.
Anti-communist, most American-loving people I know are in the Polish community. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy to hear that from him. But anyway, that kind of threw us into a little bit of a loop of like, okay, we know we have to inoculate our children. We can't tell them everything. They have to become inoculated. And by doing so, obviously, that comes from a thought process. So which liberals used to do and everybody would do, my thing about teaching the kids was think about it. What makes sense? If the socialism makes sense to you, great. But at least make sure you're honest with yourself and tell yourself, this makes sense. And in today's world, it's super simple. My daughter loves YouTube. My son loves games and stuff. He's older now. He's in the Marines and done all that on now. But when he was younger, he loved the gamings and everything else. I said, well, what's your favorite game? And he'd tell me his favorite game. And I asked my daughter, what's your favorite YouTube things or whatever. We'd find, what's your favorite? What's your favorite coffee? Dunkin' Donuts? Starbucks? You have a favorite. One's better than the other.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they can start an argument as to why one's better, one's not. I said, none of that exists without capitalism. You'll never get the best. And what's more, the proof of that is you have the next best idea. If you're going to get paid $20 an hour, no matter if it's the best idea or the worst idea, where's your incentive to go make something better? You don't have any incentive. So without the incentive, and obviously everything could be tainted, and capitalism can be corrupted. Individuals can do it, and they do it. And we have the crony capitalism, which I'm speaking.
It's interesting when capitalism is corrupted. People say, "Well, that's capitalism for you." But the defense of communism is, "Oh, that's not real communism."
That's all the 100 million dead people.
Yeah, right.
The other question, quick thing, real too, on to your point of these people going on shows. I never understood why. Well, not again, like to your point, no, but not many people can actually defend it and articulate it very well. But if you go on Jimmy Kimmel's show or one of the other shows. Hey, or even Bill Maher. So you're a big progressive, liberal, living wage, whatever. Well, how come you're not just making the – why do you get paid so much?
Yeah, put your money where your mouth is.
You know, I don't know why you should get paid. Why shouldn't Joe – and I'll point to a guy in the audience. Why shouldn't he be up here tomorrow and he can make whatever he wants? Why are you so special? There's no way he's special without a market – a capitalistic market that gave him that special chair. A communist chair will never exist for him in that world. So, yeah, the hypocrisy of these people is just disgusting. It's beyond disgusting. But if our kids aren't taught to think past the propaganda, then we're going to lose anyway.
Yeah, and they do have to be taught, Greg. I mean, teach your children well is an important – it's the most important precept here in religion as well as politics because – you know, who's going to get them? It's either the parents or stranger danger, and stranger danger can be intellectual.
It can, and in today's world.
That's why Reagan said, you know the famous Reagan quote, most people know at least the first part, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction.
Absolutely.
You know, most people don't go on to read the rest of it. I mean, not by deliberation just because it's hard to memorize, I suppose. But it, the rest of it is we don't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It has to be fought for, protected, and handed on to them to do the same. Fought for, protected, and handed on for them. Fought for, protected, and handed on. You have to fight for it every day. It doesn't just come.
And unfortunately, many kids today don't feel like they are fighting, so everything's super easy.
Yeah.
So it makes our job even harder to illustrate what people went through. I love the Revolutionary War. It was amazing to me what people walked through snow and what they did to make a bullet, to shoot one bullet.
Yeah, one musket shot. Unbelievable. Your point here is true. I mean, we live in a time, Greg, where the vast majority of Americans, at least 80%, live better than the Sun King. Okay?
Oh, boy.
Right? No, they
do.
For
sure.
When you think about indoor air conditioning, air conditioning, period, of indoor plumbing, you know, the luxuries, water, running water, the temperature, changing the temperature of the shop. No, I mean, 80 plus percent of Americans live better than the Sun King, including the children, and they want communism. 51% of them would rather live in a communist country. They don't know what they're talking about.
Maybe that's what we should be marching for at the schools. Where's the education?
Where's the hot water? Or go to Venezuela.
Yeah.
Where's the toilet paper?
Yeah. Anything.
Anything. Where's anything? Yeah. Yeah.
Great show, guys.
All right. Linda Ronstadt didn't write a song about you?
No.
Dolly Parton? Reba McEntire?
No. I have a couple of stories, but believe me, I'm sure more. There's got to be way better things to listen to than this, so I'm out. Sorry, fellas.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for checking in. Tom is in Phoenix. Hi, Tom. Did Miranda Lambert write a song about you?
I don't know how you even know who that
then
is.
Then that would be a no. Okay, what you got for me?
This is a response or a continuation, I guess, of the guy talked three or four people ago. I've been on hold for about a half hour.
I apologize
for that. You know, I've got 95% of my huge family are liberals and have always been, and I've always been conservative since the time I was about 12. You know, libs know the weaknesses of conservatives. You know, if the conservative is right and he's on one end zone and the liberal is completely wrong and he's on the other end zone, you might be even negotiating about or arguing about friggin' gravity. And what the liberal says is, what, can't we compromise at the 50-yard line? And the conservative, universally, I'm 69 years old, and I've been through, 50 years or whatever, of all the way back to college. The conservative always wants to be reasonable. The liberal knows this, and so the liberal says, can't we compromise? Now, look at abortion. It started off in 1973 at the first trimester. Where are we today, for God's sakes? I mean, the baby's got one foot stuck.
No, I hear what you're saying, Tom. I'll tell you, it is worrisome to think that they know our arguments. And my concern is that we don't know our arguments. That's my concern. That's my concern. I don't know that I have heard a strong liberal message on TV or radio or read one in print in a really long time that I thought would be that hard to refute. I really haven't seen it. I mean, there are some great ones out there, but they're a fading bunch, and I can't name very many right now. I really can't. I'm worried that we don't know our own arguments. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I'm Seth Leaps, and he's Chris Buskirk. You don't get...
You look like you want to get some pasta.
Yeah, I know. That's an... Yeah. You don't get Garth Brooks in a communist society. You just don't.
No. Nor Miranda Lambert.
Nor Miranda Lambert. Bob is in Phoenix. Hi, Bob.
Hi, guys. Hey, two simple little things. You guys and your couple of... Yes, back, we're talking about communism. Kids don't understand it. They don't teach it properly anymore. Two simple little books. It'd take about an hour, maybe 2 hours to read both of them, Animal Farm and Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
They want to scare the bejesus out of the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and the story I read on Tax Day. Do you remember the story Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut?
Oh, yeah.
That's even shorter. Yeah. That'll do it. I think I read it in one segment.
It is so blatant and obvious and explains it simply. You know, the only ones that are running the thing are the pigs.
Well,
they got big Dobermans to protect them. The rest of us are out in the field.
Yeah, no, I get it, Bob. I get it. I get where resentment comes from this, too. I get where resentment comes from this. We were celebrating Tom Wolfe yesterday, his life in full, as a man in full, and his life in letters. And Chris and I came to the same conclusion without talking about it prior, that if you want to get a good read on a good introduction to Tom Wolfe, you want to start with his 1970 essay, Radical Chic. It's almost everything you need to know about the modern socialist countercultural movement, because it takes place, right, Chris, in the upper West Side apartment of of Leonard Bernstein, and you know, just all the fancy liberals of Manhattan are there.
You read the guest list at this dinner party in honor of the Black Panthers. This is the upper crust of the upper crust.
Black Panthers. With blood on their hands. Some of them who had been arrested, some of them who had been let go, some of them who had served time. And this is where you get why there's resentment here. You get why there's a resentment. The radical becomes chic. The radical becomes esteemed. And then once it becomes chic and esteemed, it becomes normalized. So that, you know, people can, too many people, I fear, can write off a Bernie Sanders and his theories as funny, the crankiness of, you know, of a Larry David gone serious, a will-o'-the-wisp. But he's serious.
Very serious and relentless.
Relentless. May run relentless. Again. Got more votes of the youth, I believe, than Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump combined. This is a serious movement. You know, once it becomes normalized, you know, we don't even recognize it for its extremism anymore. That's the problem. We don't recognize it as its for the extreme that it is anymore. It's now just basically common Democratic Party boilerplate. Right, Chris? I mean, this is what has happened.
Exactly right.
It has become mainstreamed. So that ironically enough, Bob, and the rest of everyone here, ironically enough, our position is critiqued as extreme. We're the extremists. Remember, that's what we were called by Hillary Clinton so many times, extremists. Just like the terrorists were called extremists. That's the word they had for us. We are the extremists in the Republican Party.
Deplorables and irredeemables.
Deplorables and irredeemables for standing for such things as free enterprise, limited government, individual liberty, and traditional values. Those that used to be commonplace. The commonplace has become extreme and the extreme has become commonplace. That's where we are today. Maybe there's a book there. You don't get Tony Orlando in communist countries either. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Chris Buskirk. We'll be right back.
Radical Chic. Seth and I have been talking about it. We've talked about it a lot over the past couple of years. It's an essay that written by Tom Wolfe. He wrote it for New York Magazine in June of 1970, and it is as relevant or even more relevant today than it was almost 50 years ago. But as I like to do, I don't always want to be talking about something. Let's let them speak for themselves. This dovetails nicely with the discussion we've been having the past couple of hours about the millennials, about the baby boomers, about the need to pass on civilization from one generation to the next, and where that fails, and what happens when that fails, how it happens. Because we see it around us, and Tom Wolfe, America's greatest man of letters, passed away yesterday at 88. This is one of his landmark essays, the one that is still quoted. We're quoting it, but we're not the only ones. We're still quoted today. He says, it's entitled Radical Chic, That Party at Lenny's. He says, it's a tricky business, integrating new politics with tried and true social motifs. At 2 or 3 or 4 a.m., somewhere along in there, on August 25th, 1966, his 48th birthday, in fact, Leonard Bernstein woke up in the dark in a state of wild alarm. Leonard Bernstein, a very famous conductor, maybe the most famous conductor of his generation. That had happened before, Wolf continues. It was one of the forms of his insomnia took. So he did the usual. He got up and walked around a bit. He felt groggy. Suddenly, he had a vision, an inspiration. He could see himself, Leonard Bernstein, the egregio maestro, walking out on stage in white tie and tails in front of a full orchestra. On one side of the conductor's podium is a piano. On the other side is a chair with a guitar leaning against it. He sits in the chair and picks up the guitar. A guitar! One of those half-witted instruments like the accordion that are made for the learn-to-play-in-8-days, easy-diagram, 110 IQ, 14-year-olds of Levittown. But there's a reason. He has an anti-war message to deliver to this great, starched, white-throated audience in Symphony Hall. He goes on. For a moment, sitting there alone in his home in the small hours of the morning, Lenny thought it might just work, and he jotted the idea down. Think of the headlines. Bernstein electrifies concert audience with anti-war appeal. But then his enthusiasm collapsed. Skipping ahead a little bit, he says, these are nice, the little Roquefort cheese morsels, rolled in crushed nuts, very tasty, very subtle. It's the way the dry sackiness of the nuts tiptoes up against the dour savor of the cheese that is so nice, so subtle. Wonder what the Black Panthers eat here on the hors d'oeuvre trail. Do the Panthers like the Roquefort cheese morsels wrapped in crushed nuts this way, and asparagus tips and mayonnaise dabs, and meatball petit au coque hardy? All of which are at this very moment being offered to them on quadrooned silver platters by maids in black uniforms with hand-ironed white aprons. The butler will bring them their drinks. Deny it if you wish, but such are the pensées métaphysiques that rush through one's head on these radical chic evenings just now in New York. Wolf is describing a scene, he's describing a particular scene, but one that was typical of what was going on in New York in the late 60s and then into the early and mid 70s. And guess what? Happening again. As was so often the case, Wolf got there ahead of everybody else. He continues. He is describing a cocktail party at Leonard Bernstein's apartment, at which the upper crust of the arts in New York is there with the Black Panthers. He's invited the Black Panthers to his home. Wolf continues. He says, for example, does that huge Black Panther there in the hallway, the one shaking hands with Felicia Bernstein herself, the one with the black leather coat and the dark glasses and the unbelievable afro, is he a Black Panther going on to pick up a Roquefort cheese morsel rolled in crushed nuts from off the tray from a maid in uniform and just pop it down the gullet without so much as missing a beat of Felicia's perfect Mary Astor voice? Felicia is remarkable. She is beautiful, with that rare burnished beauty that lasts through the years. Her hair is pale blonde and set just so. She has a voice that is theatrical, to use a term from her youth. She greets the Black Panthers with the same bend of the wrist, the same tilt of the head, the same perfect Mary Astor voice with which she greets people like Jason, Dee Dee Adolph, Betty, Gian, Carlo, Schuyler, and Goddard. During those après concert suppers she and Lenny are so famous for. What evenings? She lights the candles over the dining room table, and in the Gotham gloaming, the little tremulous tips of flame are reflected in the mirrored surface of the table, a bottomless blackness with a thousand stars. And it is that moment that Lenny loves. There seem to be a thousand stars above and a thousand stars below, a room full of stars, a penthouse duplex full of stars, a Manhattan tower full of stars with marvelous people drifting through the heavens, Jason Robards, John and Dee Dee Ryan, Giancarlo Minotti, Skylar Chapin, Goddard Lieberson, Mike Nichols, Lillian Hellman, Larry Rivers, Aaron Copland, Richard Avedon, Milton and Amy Green, Lucas Foss, Jenny Terrell, Samuel Barber, Jerome Robbins, Steve Sondheim, Adolph and Phyllis Green, Betty Comden, and the Patrick O'Neills. And now, in the sense of radical chic, the Black Panthers. That huge panther there, the one Felicia is smiling her tango smile at, is Robert Bay, who just 41 hours ago was arrested in an altercation with the police, supposedly over a .38 caliber revolver that someone had, in a parked car in Queens at Northern Boulevard and 104th Street, or some such unbelievable place, and had taken to jail on a most unusual charge called criminal facilitation. And now he's out on bail and walking into Leonard and Felicia Bernstein's 13-room penthouse duplex on Park Avenue. Harassment and hassles, guns and pigs, jail and bail. They're real, these Black Panthers. The very idea of them, these real revolutionaries who actually put their lives on the line, runs through Lenny's duplex like a rogue hormone. It's great. That's a great phrase, by the way. Like running through Lenny's duplex like a rogue hormone. Everyone casts a glance or stares or tries a smile and then sizes up the house for the somehow delicious counterpoint. Deny it if you want to, but one does end up making such sweet, furtive comparisons in this season of radical chic. There's Otto Preminger in the library and Jean Vandenhoevel in the hall, and Peter and Sherry Duchin in the living room, and Frank and Donna Stanton, Gail Lumet, Sheldon Harnick, Cynthia Phipps, Burton Lane, Mrs. Auguste Heckscher, Roger Wilkins, Barbara Walters, Bob Silvers, yes, by the way, that Barbara Walters, Bob Silvers, Mrs. Richard Avedon, Mrs. Arthur Penn, Julie Belafonte, Harold Taylor, and scores more, including Charlotte Curtis, women's news editor of the New York Times, America's foremost chronicler of society, a lean woman in black with her notebook out and standing near Felicia and big Robert Bay and talking to Sheree Duchin. Sheree tells her, "I've never met a panther. This is a first for me." Never dreaming that within 48 hours her words will be on the desk of the President of the United States. This is the Seth and Chris Show. Welcome back. Radical Chic. It's an essay written by Tom Wolfe in 1970 for New York Magazine. It's long. It's probably 15,000 words. But it describes what happens to a society when the upper crust, the aristocracy of that society, don't think we have an aristocracy, we do, when the aristocracy of that society flirts with the forces that would bring that society down on everyone else's heads. That's what Tom Wolfe was describing then. Ronald Reagan had a few words to say on a similar subject. We've got the audio for that queued up, talking about communism. Bill, why don't we just, this is a short segment, why don't we go right to it?
Finally, there is a great tradition of warnings in presidential farewells. And I've got one that's been on my mind for some time. But oddly enough, it starts with one of the things I'm proudest of in the past 8 years. The resurgence of national pride that I called the new patriotism. This national feeling is good, but it won't count for much, and it won't last unless it's grounded in thoughtfulness and knowledge. An informed patriotism is what we want. And are we doing a good enough job teaching our children what America is and what she represents in the long history of the world? Those of us who are over 35 or so years of age grew up in a different America. We were taught very directly what it means to be an American. And we absorbed almost in the air a love of country and an appreciation of its institutions. If you didn't get these things from your family, you got them from the neighborhood, from the father down the street who fought in Korea, or the family who lost someone at Anzio. Or you could get a sense of patriotism from school. And if all else failed, you could get a sense of patriotism from the popular culture. The movies celebrated democratic values and implicitly reinforced the idea that America was special. TV was like that, too, through the mid-60s. But now we're about to enter the 90s, and some things have changed. Younger parents aren't sure that an unambivalent appreciation of America is the right thing to teach modern children. And as for those who create the popular culture, well-grounded patriotism is no longer the style. Our spirit is back, but we haven't re-institutionalized it. We've got to do a better job of getting across that America is freedom. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of enterprise, and freedom is special and rare.
Let's leave it there, Bill. Let's leave it there. There's more to it, and we should play it. Maybe we'll do that tomorrow, but he's right. We need to re-institutionalize these things. It's one thing to get a spirit. We're very much in a similar position today, right? President Trump has helped reinvigorate that spirit, that American spirit, but it needs to be institutionalized so that it can be taught. You cannot love what you do not know. How do you know things? Because you're taught those things. It needs to be taught in our families, in our schools, in the culture, or it will not last.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.